2 Samuel 18. Let's pray again. Because God, it is on you that we're dependent to know truth, to know wisdom. Say the fear of you is the beginning of wisdom, and pretty confident that most all of us are here today because we want more wisdom concerning you. Want to know you better, want to know who you are, and what you want, and what it means to have a relationship with you. And God, we don't excel in that, we don't grow in that, we don't gain in that without a willingness to submit to your authority. That's the fear of you. The fear of you isn't being terrorized about unpredictability or untrustworthiness. You are absolutely trustworthy. And I would contend, even on some level, predictable from the standpoint that you do not change. You're the same yesterday, today, and forever. Your character is proven. Character is sure. So God, please help us grow in our understanding of you, because that's what matters today. Amen. So, chapter 18 is kind of the end of Absalom's rebellion. Tough character to deal with. You know, the one hand, I was reading through it last night, I think, and there was a statement made, and you know, my wife's take was that wasn't a very nice thing to say about him, kind of, because Absalom, you know, poor guy, he's hung in a tree or something, you know, and caught there, and feeling sorry for him, and that, you know, Absalom is the kind of guy that, not sure that you can't on one hand have compassion for, but yet on the other hand he was utterly rebellious towards his dad, towards his authority over him, contend even towards God. He allowed the failures of his father to ruin him. And that's something that we all can learn from. You know, do we learn from and move on and become men and women of God, submissive to God our Father, or are we going to be held captive and in bondage and pounded our whole lives by the failures of our fathers? That's something that we talk a lot about these days. We have a choice. You know, Jesus died to give us that choice. Jesus died to give us the choice to be set free from the bondage, from the strongholds that our fathers and our culture, our parents, our childhood, our upbringing puts in us. We talk a lot about the fact, and the way that I perceive it to be, as the enemy is, and it's why parenting at a young age is so critical. It's so easy to go to get consumed and change in poopy diapers and throw up and sick kids and managing craziness. And in that process, lose sight of the fact of that the enemy is after your kids hard. Not just in the woo-woo, the ghosts are around thing. I mean, he's after your children hard and things he set in place for generations. He's after the sins of a father that have come down on his sons for seven generations. You know, that the enemy's very careful to put those into a family. to mold and shape a kid at a very young age, so that he doesn't have to pay so much attention the rest of their life. They're damned and going to hell. And we can change that. You know, as parents, we need to be very careful that to realize that, you know, the enemy, I'm confident, the enemy is very purposeful in, at a young age to develop a character and a direction that he doesn't have to put much time into. It will not trust the father. It will be rebellious towards authority. It will be have strong survival skills and self-protection skills that I'm going to put walls up and not let people in. You know, the worst thing, almost the worst thing that can happen, you know, my dad, I love my dad. He's so sweet. My dad's so nice. My dad's a nice guy when your dad's a passive, selfish man. You know, one of the tragic things that can happen, because I find that to be one of the hardest things to get over, when your dad was a nice guy. You know, mom was the bad one. Almost always if dad's the nice guy, mom's the bad one. You know, it's the way it works out in life. That's because dad is too selfish to meet mom's needs. And mom's desperate and mom's crazy because dad isn't meeting her needs. But dad's a nice guy. The enemy is very purposeful to shape and mold the character that God formed to be a child of his, a creation that he meant to have intimate fellowship with, that he created to blossom in health and holiness to an intimate, passionate, vibrant, fulfilling relationship with him. The joy of the Lord is my strength should be our characterization, not the things of this world beat the crap out of me every day. You know, it should be the joy of the Lord is my strength. But the enemy's careful to cause us to shape and form. Absalom, unfortunately, you know, there's a side of it that there's some things about David that, man, what a dad, you know. David had a legitimate hero side. You know, wasn't just Goliath, you know. I mean, David had killed a bear and killed a lion with his hands, you know. Grabbed a hold of him, beat him to death with his club, you know, doing it. I mean, yeah, you know, that's dad hero stuff, you know, that he was pretty fearless when it came to that. But for whatever reason, David's permissiveness or David's passiveness, David's unwillingness to deal with the sin in his family, trashed Absalom, trashed his family. So here we are, David coming to a really tough crossroads in his life to live with that, and Absalom coming to see the end result of that. And it's a pretty tragic story. David at this point, I believe that David, when David marched out of Jerusalem, I think part of it is strategically he was wise enough to realize, man, I don't have much gathered, not much army here, or much anything. He obviously left quickly. You know, they didn't have beds, utensils, food. It's not like they got the camper loaded up, went for a trip. You know, they blew out of there pretty quick. I also think that it, you know, some of it had to do with victory, but from his relationship with Absalom and his willingness to stay at the end of chapter 18, that I wish that it was me that died. David wasn't running scared. And I believe that, and David just didn't want to win and have victory. I believe that he was trying to avoid an ugly, ugly conflict with his son. I mean, David didn't want that conflict with his son. And David, you know, this is the thing that, and I've said this for last month probably in context here, that unfortunately David was pounded by guilt and shame. Okay? Now there's, and I was thinking about this a lot yesterday particularly, but this morning and actually for the last couple of weeks, but, you know, sin, we need to realize that you reap what you sow. That's a principle that God put in this world, period. And sin has consequences. That's a very important thing to understand. We don't just do what we want and be rebellious towards God and act however we feel, and then we can come back and say we're sorry and everything will be fine. Okay? That's not the way it goes. When we spit in God's face, we're rebellious towards God, we go against what God has called us to, what God's heart is, what God has directed, how God has directed us, we go against that, and there's consequences of it. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that Jesus died to set us free from guilt and shame. That's a direct statement of one of the purposes, of a primary purpose that he died for. You know, I look at this, David wasn't set free from guilt and shame, you know, obviously by his actions. I mean, David was still held captive, and I was thinking a lot about what that looked like in context of Old Testament and New Testament. And honestly, I don't know that I have an absolute answer, except that I do know this in New Testament times, that we can be born again, that we can become new creatures, that we can be renewed in our minds. I believe that when, in Romans, when Paul talks about the renewing of your mind, that he's reprogramming the synaptic connections, how you respond to stimuli, how you respond to things that the enemy has worked so careful to push buttons in, you know? I mean, one of the ways the enemy holds us captive is by putting all these little pressure points, these little buttons, you know, and then telling your wife where they are, you know, or the world, telling the world where they are, whatever. Well, you're not supposed to have those little buttons to begin with, okay? It's your problem. It's our problem. And I'm speaking to men. It goes vice versa. It goes both ways. We're one. And when I speak of men, you know, a man is not a husband and a father, obviously, without a wife. And so the two are to become one flesh and function as one flesh. But he works very careful to put those connections so we respond to certain stimuli in a very selfish, wicked, survival way. Overwhelms us, controls us, determines us. And I'm confident that the process of the Holy Spirit renewing our minds in the process of when we are born again, which honestly, I mean, the thing that we have to be careful of is, I mean, the question should be asked, are you born again? You know, and I don't want to see a certificate of baptism that confirms that, you know, or a statement of intellectual truth that confirms that. Because most people that are born again aren't, think they're born again or not. You know, I don't know what the latest statistic is, but when I heard probably 10 years ago was that 70% of the people in this country think they're born again. We're not saying just Christians, but born again, which is a ridiculous statement. Because as lights in this world, people who are born again are going to be lights, are going to be salt in this world. We wouldn't have looked like we do for the last 10 years as a country. We wouldn't have acted the way we do. So there's a tremendous deception. And the enemy's really purposeful about that. Be sure. He wants us to believe that we're born again, that we have the power of God, that the Holy Spirit lives in me, when it's not really true, because then I go on living this struggling, impotent life. And if you're not born again, you are going to be determined by guilt and shame. Okay? Jesus says we can be set free from guilt and shame, which is a very, which determines our actions, man. There's few things more powerful. There's few things that cripple a father to be a father more than guilt and shame. Okay? Guilt and shame of sexual perversion, guilt and shame of selfishness, guilt and shame of anger, guilt and shame of, you know, of past and present actions that come. Sin brings guilt and shame. Okay? Period. All sin brings guilt and shame. Jesus died to set us free from guilt and shame. We can be set free from that bondage. Okay? If we're born again, what does it mean to be born again? Obviously, that's, you know, I'm a pretty strong believer that we become disciples of Jesus prior to being born again. We tend to see it the other way. We tend to think that, no, get saved and then you can become a disciple of Jesus. I think that's a lie. Because The necessity in being born again is to relinquish the entirety of your will to your master. Okay? Obviously not perfected in any one of us yet, but that is the state that you come to of a willing relinquishing of the entirety of your will to your master. Are you going to do that to somebody you don't know? Or somebody you don't trust? Or somebody you perceive to be somewhat iffy or distant or not really concerned about your life, not really concerned about the little things in your life, not really concerned about... I can just say, I don't care what you say with your mouth, you're not willing to do that. Okay? You would be a fool to do that. You would be a fool to relinquish the entirety if you walk down the street and somebody goes, some guy can walk out, man, I can make your life completely different, man. I can turn your life around. I can take care of your debt. I can take care of all the issues in your life. You won't have to work again for the rest of your life. Everything will be good. Just submit to me. Just come and follow me. You go, well, that sounds pretty good, man. That's what I want, right? I want that. Okay, let's go. I'm in. Yeah, you work for Amway, yeah. And you know, I'm gonna give in to that. To some... No. Now, everybody in this room would go, that was kind of stupid, right? You'd be a fool to do that. Right? And yet that's what we expect of people when we say, say the prayer, man! You want your life to be better? You want somebody to take care of things in your life? You want somebody to take care of the problem? Forgive your sin, go to heaven, live eternally, do all this. Well, heck yeah, I do. Well then, just turn your life over to... Turn your life over to Jesus, to a master. You know, most people never get to that point. It's the parable of the sower, you know, where seed falls on ground and people willingly go, yeah, I'm in. It springs up, but there's no soil. The soil isn't good. It's next to the road. It's rocky ground. Or the bird comes up and snatches it away. There's little of it that gets planted in soil. I believe it's the soil of somebody who is a disciple of Jesus. I believe that soil is the context of that soil is somebody who is a follower of Jesus who's gone, well, I hear about him, I know about him, so I might better figure out who he really is. And as the Holy Spirit begins to reveal who he is and who God is and what the truth of God is and his trustworthiness and his faithfulness and his credibility and his ability to handle your life, you finally come to the point because anybody who says relinquishing your will entirely is just, oh yeah, that was easy, man, I just... We do it like a little kid goes, I'll do whatever you say, Mom, if I can have some ice cream. Right? I'll do everything. I'll be, I'm sorry, I won't be bad anymore, ever again, if I can have some ice cream. Right? That kid mean that? Mm-mm. At the moment he does, he really, really, really means it. You know? Does he mean it in his soul enough that he's willing to, I will not rebel against you ever again if I can have some ice cream right now. I don't think that's what he means, okay? And I don't think that's what most of us mean, you know? This isn't, I can take on salvation, I want to gain salvation, and then I'll decide if I'm going to let you be Lord when I do and when I don't. But I'm still saved, man. I'm good, okay? Still got the deal. I got the, you know, and we, you know, it's ridiculous. But I know I am, but I'm assured of it, but I feel confident, and I know I'm saved. Really? I mean... There's Buddhists that believe they're saved. There's Hindus that believe they're saved. There are certainly Muslims that believe they're saved. You know? There's Catholics that believe they're saved because we do penance, because we confess our sins to the priest, because we light candles, because we say, you know, the rosary. And you live your life that way and you grow up that way believing it and I feel confident in this, right? Having confidence in yourself or confidence in something is doesn't necessarily make it to be true. You can convince somebody and cause them to believe something very strongly. So because I feel really strongly, of course, because I really want to, that doesn't mean anything. Does it conform? Does it go with this? Okay? So follow the description of this God. Is it based in the truth of this book? And that's not that, oh no, I believe this and I tag the Bible on. Kind of like Mormons do, right? We believe it in the Bible's our source of authority, right? Is it really? No. That's not their source of authority. Their source of authority is the Book of Mormon. Okay? Pearl of great price. You know, this is just tagged on a side to make it woo-woo, to make it holy, to make it powerful. Here's David in the process of, some of it is reaping what he sowed. I think that there was a time when David was consumed and controlled by guilt and shame, understandably and rightfully so. And just watched his world collapse around him. And now he's got his son Absalom, who's probably next in line to be king, probably was headed that direction to be king. And, you know, he's already got one son that was killed because of rape. Right, wrong, sideways, I'm not sure. Deserved to be killed. Now we've got another son who is living in utter rebellion. Everything going for him. You know, I don't think saying that he was a pretty boy. You know, he, it's hard for us in our culture. You know, my sons hate long hair, you know, doing it. I don't know why. You know, it's kind of like they hate cigarettes. I didn't teach them to hate cigarettes either. But somehow our culture taught them to hate cigarettes. I'm not saying cigarettes are good, you know. But somehow in the culture, man, they were taught cigarettes bad. You know, doing it. They hate cigarettes and doing it. And they also don't think Fabio's cool, okay? I mean, the hair is just not cool. He doesn't look like a man, doesn't act like a man. They don't think of him as a man, okay? Doing it. Long hair is not cool, okay? It's interesting in reading, you know, things like, back old commentary stuff. I was reading some old commentary stuff, and it's amazing how the long hair thing, the cultural perception of long hair kind of feeds into some commentary. Oh, really? Yeah, it does. You know, which I don't know that it's right, you know, because culturally long hair is seen different throughout time, okay? The Bible is somewhat clear in that it says boys aren't to look like girls, okay? And long hair, women, it's a point of honor. Men, it's a point of dishonor in doing it. You know, and the Bible speaks of that. But, you know, saying that there was no imperfection from the tip of his toes, the tip of his head, to say that, you know, I mean, it tells about his hair. I mean, obviously he had some hair, you know. You know, cut it once a year, you know, or something, because it was so heavy. And, you know, so much of the commentary throws in this concept of the pride of Absalom because of his hair. I don't really read that, you know, doing it. I'm not sure that he was necessarily a standout, but I am convinced that Absalom was a standout beyond just his good looks and his hair. He wasn't just Fabio and a pretty boy. He couldn't have gotten the nation Israel to follow Fabio, okay? Wasn't going to happen, okay? They weren't going to rebel against David, risk their lives for Fabio, okay? If he was sitting at the gate, you know, when everybody came in and going, oh, poor you, you know, if he wasn't a sharp, talented, articulate politician, wouldn't have got it done. He wasn't just a smooth-talking pretty boy, you know. He sat there at the gate and he turned the whole nation against David. That's pretty good. That's impressive. He was more than just a pretty boy. So here's David's son who had everything going for him. And yet he's in utter rebellion to David and to God based on the fact that he allowed the failure of his father to consume him and destroy him. So, verse 24 of chapter 17 says, David came to Mahanaim and Absalom crossed the Jordan. He and all the men of Israel with him. Remember, they'd been advised. He'd been advised to hurry up, go after him right now, get him killed before he crossed the Jordan. And then Hushai, David's friend, came in and advised him, no, don't do that. I think it'd be better if you waited a little bit and got all Israel around you and rallied the whole nation around you. And then you went with them into battle. That would prove to be his undoing, you know. I'm also convinced that God was in the process of, you know, Absalom was a rebellious son. Absalom was rebellious towards his dad. He was rebellious towards God. Doesn't matter. You know, there comes a point in each of our lives where the things that molded and shaped us and determined us and shaped our character and formed our character, we become responsible for them and no longer is the excuse of somebody else. Okay? There comes a point in our lives where we all have to take ownership of our sin, of our rebellion. You know? It's real easy for me to go, you know, to look at my wife and go, your dad really failed you, man. You're just like your dad. You know, you act like your dad doing it, okay? And it ain't her dad's problem anymore. It's my fault and my problem, okay? I have failed my wife. Obviously for a lot longer than her dad did, you know? She was young then. I've known her for, you know, we've been hanging out for twice as long as she lived with her dad. Oops. Guess I don't get to blame that anymore. You know, have I reshaped and reformed and redone? Really, it's not true. I'm just using it for example because my wife doesn't have faults. But, you know, other than that. So, there is a time where we all have to take... Absalom should have said, my dad set a bad example. My dad did not act as a father as he should have acted. My dad wrong, but God, I'm going to serve you. And Absalom didn't do that. Absalom let his bitterness go. I'm going to self-promote. I'm going to self-defend. I'm going to not follow the Most High God. I'm going to be religious. You know, I mean, he called the Ahithophel, who, you know, and he called the priests and he tried to make it look good and tried to cover it over with religion, but he was rebellious. So they had some time here. I don't know how much time. It doesn't really say. It seems like it's pretty sequentially immediate. I don't think it was sequentially immediate. I think that Absalom had to rally the whole nation and bring soldiers from all over the country, from all over Israel, south, north, all over. And they came and rallied behind Absalom. And in that process, and Ahithophel knew this would happen. That's why he advised not to wait. I am also convinced that a lot of people rallied behind David. Okay? So how much time this took, we don't quite know. David actually was going to the far end. You know, this place called Mahanaim is probably it's on the border basically of Israel. It's about to be out. It's like kind of in the farthest corner, northeast corner of Israel. And David, moved clear up there. That is actually where Saul's son, Ishbosheth, had set up rule. Remember, over the northern kingdoms when David was set up in Hebron over the southern kingdoms doing it. That's where he'd set up his deal up there. It actually became it was originally given as a city of the Levites. And so, you know, this was a long established city fortress doing it for whatever reason. I think David went to the furthest reaches, I think, to try to avoid conflict. I think David said, man, I'm leaving Jerusalem. I'm going to go away. I'm going to go as far away as I can. But Absalom was not going to leave it alone. He was going to go kill him. He could have left David. I don't know what David would have done in the long run, but he was tail-tuck going, of trying to avoid conflict in this deal. And I think there was people that gathered to him there, and just like there's people that gathered Absalom. So now you've let David gain the advantage again or strengthen his forces. So they both crossed. Absalom sent Amasa over the army in place of Joab. Now Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Jithra, the Israelite, who went in to Abigail, the daughter of Nashon, sister of Zuro, Joab's mother. You know, why does he give us all that information? You know. Amasa was a nephew like Job was from a different mother. So, they were related in the family. He put him over in Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. That's the whole area, the whole region that Mahanaim was in as a city. So they camped in the land of Gilead. Now when David had come to Mahanaim, Shobi, the son of Nasha, from Rabbah, the sons of Ammon, Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodibar, and Barzilla, the Gileadite, from Rogalim, brought beds, basins, pottery, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, lentils,
parched seeds, honey, curds, sheep, and cheese of the herd for David and for the people who were with him to eat. For they said, these people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Interesting group of men there that brought these things. These actually were ex-enemies of David. You know? These were brothers of, remember Nathan? Nathan was one of the guys when David sent some of his men to mourn over his father's death, and he goes, no, they're just spying on us, and he shaved their heads. This is his brother, you know? It tells me that, I mean, these guys didn't have to do this, obviously. They weren't obligated to do this. It's a pretty big deal. There was potentially, some have speculated, up to 4,000 soldiers. And there was families. There was a bunch of people. I don't know how many Kurds they brought, but that's a bunch of Kurds, you know. Fair amount of sheep. I mean, there was a lot of things. Beds, utensils, all the things they needed to recoup and get together and be ready to go fight a war. And you know, it tells me about, it speaks to me of the mercy and compassion of David in his warring. David was a fighter, but he was fair. David obviously these guys were Philistine guys for the most part, were enemies. Just like, you know, one of David's gonna set over his commanders, you know, Ittai, the Gittite, was not a Israeli either. He was not a Jew either, okay? He was a foreigner too. But there was a fair amount of David's enemies that respected him, that looked up to him, that saw that David, even though he had conquered, was not ruthless and was not brutal like a lot of people were and killed mercilessly. David seemed to kill to the point where people were submissive and then quit. Still killed, you know. I mean, it's a different world they lived in. But these were ex-enemies and relatives of the enemies of David. They brought this. So now David's recouping and rejuvenating and getting it together. And David was a general. I mean, David had unbelievable victory. Remember, even when David was young, right after Goliath, man, Saul put him in charge of a kind of a special forces group of guys, man. He went out and had victory after victory after victory after victory. Remember, even as a young boy, they said, Saul has killed his thousands, but David is tens of thousands. I mean, David was strategically and as a general and as a leader of men was on top. As strong a leader as it gets. And now all of a sudden you give him a little bit to get his feet underneath him because David is struggling. David is really struggling with this Absalom thing. What do I do? You know, what do I do here? What's the right thing to do? And I believe that David, in a way, showed the love and compassion of a father. You know, he in a way exemplified the love and compassion of a father, just like God does, where God longs and desires for reconciliation with us. You know, all of us have been rebellious children. All of us have done things worthy of death. All of us have spit in God's face with our actions, okay? All of us have. We're all deserving of death, and yet God relentlessly says, but I want to redeem our relationship. But I want to make our relationship what I created it to be. I am willing to forgive. And that was David. The side of it, that was his heart. On the other hand, David, for whatever reason, lived by family rules in a very strong way, both with Joab, his relatives, his nephews, and his uncles, and he lived in this mess of we don't reprove and correct our children, it seems to be. You know, they were passive about being dads. You know, his own son raped his daughter, and he did nothing about it. You know, you see, that's pretty strong. But that says a lot. Says everything. He did nothing about it. And should have. You know, Ammon should have been, you know, killed. Truthfully. Culturally, he could have married Tamar. But David didn't do anything about it. In fact, he sent her away shamed, is what he did. David was a passive father who wasn't willing. And Absalom was a result of this. Absalom was angry towards his father. So that David numbered the people who were with him, chapter 18, verse 1, and set over them commanders of thousands, and commanders of hundreds. And David sent the people out, one third under the command of Joab, one third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Job's brother, and one third under Zeruiah wasn't Job's brother. Zeruiah was the mother, and Job's brother was Abishai. The way it goes sometimes, you have to read context doing it, but under the command of Ittai, the Gittite, and the king said to the people, I myself will surely go out with you also. David, I think David was realizing, man, remember, there's a pretty vivid time when David didn't go out with, and David is pretty burdened with the fact that, you know, he was irresponsible as a king. He did not go out and lead his men. Remember that last time? When he stayed home and then had an affair with Bathsheba, ended up killing Uriah, when David should have been with his men on the battleground. But this tells me something about David's heart. So David said, I'm going to go. You know, I'm not going to do that again. You know, that was wrong. I should have been with you on the battle. But the impressive thing to me again with David always is a broken and contrite heart. I believe that David left Jerusalem with a broken and contrite heart. I mean, we talked about it last week. Who was he led by? You know, he was obviously led by God because of the response towards Shimei, I remember when he was kicking dust and throwing rocks at him, mocking him, saying things about him that was bad, remember? And he was led by the Spirit of God. You could tell that by his response to him because he didn't have Abishai cut his head off, you know, doing it, which was legally correct and okay and could have always happened. And, you know, I mean, there was a bunch of guys. You look at guys like Benaiah. I mean, there was some guys. We'll get to it later on. There was some guys with David right now that were just, they were the real deal. I mean, when we read the list of mighty men that followed David, they make the Navy SEALs look pretty pathetic, you know, doing it. I mean, these guys were bad dudes, man. I mean, they were all with him there, you know, when they were mocking David. And David was humble and broken and contrite and said, no, I don't need to self-defend. I don't need to self-protect. I am, you know, in fact, I've sinned. I'm deserving of reproof and correction. I'm deserving of his mocking. I mean, I have made a mess of things, man. I mean, I've made a tragic mess of my family and of the kingdom. And David seemed to continue this mentality as he went. One of the things that is sweet here, when they said, he said, I'll go with you. But the people said, you should not go out. For if we indeed flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. They'll basically let us go. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore now it is better that you be ready to help us from the city. Then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood by the gate and all the people went out by hundreds and thousands. That's a pretty, that's a big statement, okay? You know, I make a statement quite often and the men hear this because I believe that it's very true. And you've all heard it if you've been around me much, but a man out from under authority is a very dangerous man. Okay? Period. God calls us as men not to be, you know, lone individuals who make our own roads and forge our own way and do our own thing. God meant us not to be passive men, not to be cowardice men, not to be unwilling to be bold and brave and virtuous and heroic, because he calls us to do those things. A man out from under authority, though, is a very dangerous man. And that will look like, we can all say, but I'm under the authority of God, and that's what my authority is. But let me just be real clear. God will put a lot of other authority in your life, too. Okay? What does that look like? You know, in the modern church, in the church, that looks like elders. Elders, the Bible talks about elders being. There's not a senior pastor that I can find anywhere in here. Okay? But there's elders, and God calls us to be under elders. I'm an elder. So mind me, Mallory. No. I'm an elder, and that's what I am. And that is, in the church, I am charged with responsibility. Me, I am called to be absolutely under authority. I'm called to be under the authority of the other men. This, to me, reflects the heart of David. David was willing to be under the authority of the men around him. It tells me where David was at. And rightfully so. You know, they said, no, you're going to be more of a liability than an asset. Let's go fight here. you know, we need you to stay here. We need you to stay here and be backup in case we get in trouble somewhere along the way. We need, and you will just be a distraction in this deal. So we won't be able to guard and protect you necessarily. The place where they chose to fight was pretty profound. And they were wise there. But the good thing is David's pride and his ego were set aside. David didn't say, I'm going to go. They also realized, I believe, that he would be a liability when it came to defeating Absalom. That they did not know that he would act correctly. The right thing for them to do was to, from a political, from the nation Israel perspective, from what God had set up and the order God had set up, the right thing for them to do was to stop the insurrection, to stop the rebellion of Absalom and to kill him in his rebellion. That was the right thing to do. They were afraid. They had watched David not be a good father. They had watched David not deal with sin in his own family. They had watched David be passive towards the sins of his sons, and they said, you're going to be a liability here. We have to do this as a job due for your sake as the king. Our responsibility is to protect you, is to fight for you, is to defend you, is to defend the kingdom doing that. And you're going to keep us from doing this if you go with us. And David was submissive to that, even though I'm sure that there's a side of him that very much would have liked to have been on the battlefield to protect Absalom. I think David had there's a side of David that, as a father, had the heart of God of, man, I want to give Absalom the opportunity to repent. I want to give Absalom the opportunity to turn away from his sin and his rebellion. I want to give Absalom the possibility of having a right relationship with God. Because Absalom died in his rebellion. And that sets him in an eternally ugly place. And David knew that. And I think David longed as a father to do that. But on the other hand, David was still, he was not set free from guilt and shame. I guess that's the whole deal of what could he have been. I think that he could have been. I know that we can be. That we can be and we must be, or we will trash our children if we remain as men. And all of us on some level have reason for guilt and shame. Okay? All of us. And if we don't, we haven't faced our sin. If we haven't faced our sin, well, you're damned anyway. Okay? So, we all have reason for guilt and shame, but we can be set free from that and not function in that with our wives, with our kids. And David wasn't set free from this at this point. He was still held by that. So, the king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. Then the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter there that day was great, 20,000 men. For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. I've tried to figure that out for the last month, what that means and what that looks like. And what's that? Prince's Bride, yeah. The forest devoured him. Here's the thing that we do know. You know, there was oaks, and it was torn up country, and there was ravines, and there was potholes and pits and mires and stuff around the river, Jabbok, and the land was pretty torn up, you know. It wasn't this sweet, nice forest of nice trees doing it. It was oak and oak brush, and, you know, it was a mess of a place. Not this great big fields where you could fight necessarily, but God chose, David chose, whatever. I'm convinced that this is put in here purposely, and I don't doubt this is what happened. I mean, it seems a little hard to understand, right? People were running into bushes and dying, you know? I mean, it seems a little hard to understand doing it. But I'm confident that it was put in here, the forest devoured more people that day to show the hand of God. There was another, I want to read something back in back in Moses' day, when there was another rebellion, and the people were rebelling against Moses, rebelling against God, against Moses and Aaron, and coming against them, and they were angry and feeling like they'd let him out and were rebelling against the authority and wanted to go off and leave. And the Lord spoke to Aaron and Moses. I'll just read it here. Number 16, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron saying, "Separate yourself from among this congregation that I may consume them instantly." But they fell on their faces and said, "O God, thou God of the spirits of all flesh, when one man sins, will you be angry with the entire congregation?" Then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Okay, speak to the congregation saying, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abram." Then Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abram with the elders of Israel following him. And he spoke to the congregation saying, "Depart now from the tents of these wicked men." And again, it's important to read Numbers and Deuteronomy and see the character and nature of God. "And touch nothing that belongs to them," Moses said, "lest you be swept away in all their sin." He said, "You guys better get away from these guys right now, because God's going to do something." They were rebellious. They were rebelling against Moses and Aaron, who God had set up. So they got back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abram. And Dathan and Abram came out and stood at the door of their tents, along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. What are you going to do, kill kids? You know, I don't know what their deal was, but they came out with all their families, okay? And Moses said, "By this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds, for this is not my doing. If these men die the death of all men, a normal death, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me." Okay? These guys just die, or I go kill them with a sword or something. But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is theirs, and they descend alive into Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. Then it came about, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the men who belonged to Korah and their possessions. It wasn't just a few people, there was a bunch of people in this tribe. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, and they said, "The earth may swallow us up." Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. I think this is the same type of a deal. God said, "I'll go fight for you." I mean, 20,000 guys were killed doing it. I don't know if that's the ones they killed with swords, and then there was more that were killed by the bushes. I don't know. But that's a bunch. You know, I don't know what the numbers are right now, but there was a point when the whole Afghan war, there was 6,000 people, maybe 6,000 guys died or something. You know, 20,000 died this day in this war. And I believe that God has showed that they were getting killed. It was an ugly thing. They were broken up. It was really tight confines, oaks and bushes and cut up and cliffs and gullies and ravines. And it was not necessarily a place to, where there was, you know, an open battle where you could kind of see who was what. There was people coming out from behind you and front of you and every which way. I think it was a pretty wild scene, obviously. Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule. And the mule went under the thick branch of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, so that he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule there under him kept going. Now, oftentimes that's interpreted, he got caught. See, his vanity, his hair. His hair was so long that he got caught in his hair. Didn't say that, okay? How he got caught up, it would seem to me that if he was caught in his hair, I'm sure he had a sword, and if you didn't have a sword, you would have had an extra knife on you or something, and not a problem to cut your hair, you know, even break your hair off or tear your hair off, I don't know what, you know. He was left hanging here. I mean, things are not going well. You're a little vulnerable and you're hanging up in this tree. Not dead. Somehow you were so held by his head. Caught in a Y of a tree between branches. I've tried to envision it, what that would look like. How you could not get yourself free from this thing. Okay? But he couldn't. He was caught there. And even when the enemy saw him, he didn't go, oh man, get out of here. I mean, he couldn't get out. To me, it's, what are the odds of that? You know, I would contend not well. No, you've never heard of it before. I'd say you never hear of it again. Okay. And yet it really happened. He got caught somehow riding on his mule. The mule thing, I don't know, you know. The mule is a little suspect because the Old Testament God said, do not breed, do not do that. Okay? Do not breed animals that aren't the same. Don't breed a donkey and a horse together doing it. That's what a mule is. God had told him not to do it. Absalom was doing a few things, not. You know, a mule typically was quite a bit taller than a donkey. I mean, they rode donkeys. Donkeys weren't bad. I don't know why you're a donkey, man. I've ridden a donkey. Have any of you ridden a donkey before? It's a nasty little thing, man. I mean, they've got these really strong withers, and they walk like this. Man, I tell you what, man, you got to have some tough butt to be riding that deal on it. But they rode donkeys. Horses much better, gated, doing it. For whatever reason, he wasn't riding a horse. I don't know, but he's riding a mule. Mules typically are taller. Obviously, it was tall enough. When he got caught up in the branch, the mule took off, and he was left hanging there. So, again... Justice. Vengeance is mine. We talked about it last week. Trust God. Vengeance is his. And I don't know quite who was trusting what because Job doesn't necessarily act correctly. So that his mule kept going. When the certain man saw it, he told Joab and said to him, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. And Joab said to the man who said to him, now behold, you saw him? Why did you not strike him there on the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. That probably means that he would have, the implication there, the belt implication is you would have become a commander, man. I'd have raised you up as an army, man. You'd have been a hero, you know. I'd have done this. But the man said, you know, this shows the followers of David, you know, there was some faithful men who follow David. And the man said to Joab, even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, protect for me the young man Absalom. Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. That's a big thing. You wouldn't even sit up for me. I mean, he's talking to Job. I don't know who this guy was. But this is another one of those Uriah kind of guys. Good guy, okay? Good guy. Didn't kill Absalom. Would have been the hero in Job's eyes, right? Job said, man, I'd have made you a hero. I'd have made you a captain. I'd have made you a commander here doing this. He said, are you kidding me? You know, I'm not going to go against the king. I am here to protect the king. And the king said he wanted his son protected. Right or wrong, he said he wanted his son from. And besides, he says to Job, you'd have been a chicken something anyway and not even defended me if I'd have done it. I know your character. That's a big statement, he said to Joab. You know, Job was a pretty ruthless guy. But it was true. You know, he said, you'd left me out to dry. You'd hung me out to dry, man. I'd have done it, Job would have said, I don't know, man, you told us not to, but he did it, I guess, well, whatever. You know, and he knew that, and he knew the character in Job. To speak that way was pretty profound. And it took Job back enough that Job didn't even respond. Okay? And otherwise, then Job said, I will not waste my time here with you. Get away. I'm going to hear you, you know. What he said was true. Everything he said was true. He's supposed to, David had charged them not to do it. He declared, did you not forget, did you? You know, David had charged doing it. Everything he said was true on doing it. And yet, he said, I will not waste my time here with you. So we took 3 spears in his hand, thrust them through the heart of Absalom. Heart Typically, the word heart means the center mass of your body. It wasn't speaking of the actual heart. It was meaning center mass in your body. You know, this the center of your being is in that, probably through the stomach. He took three spears in his hand and thrust them to the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And ten young men who carried Job's armor gathered around him and struck Absalom and killed him. Then Job did the right thing and Job did the wrong thing. Right? Job's job was to protect the king. Job's job was to fight for the kingdom. Joab was a man out from under authority, though. That's the thing that makes him, and it destroyed his life. That's the difference in him and David, you know. Joab was a man, was it right for him to kill and stop the insurrection, for him to kill the traitor, for him to kill the guy who was trying to kill his king? Yeah, that was his job. He was did he look at David and go, David's terrible fathering will not do the right thing here, will blind him. He understood that. Was that true? Yeah, that was true. But he was out from under authority. David, his king, had commanded him to protect Absalom. And he didn't. The truth is, again, he did the right thing, but he did it as a man out from under authority. Doing the right thing isn't necessarily the right thing to do. This will come back to bite. It will cost him his life. Along with the other ways that he acted that were right things to do as a commander, as a protector of David, looking out for David's best interest. He was doing the right thing. It was the right thing. But he was a man out from under authority. He was a man not submissive to authority. And as a result, it'll cost him his life in a bad way. Then Job blew the trumpet and the people returned from pursuing Israel and Joab restrained the people. Remember, these are all David's subjects. All of Israel or David's nation, man. Just a short period of time ago, these were all subjects of David. These are part of his army, right? If David's going to subdue the Philistines, if David's going to fight against the Moabites or the Amorites or the Hittites or the whateverites, David, these were his men. These were his people. These were the people of his country until Absalom turned the tide. Actually, until David set a bad example of immorality and wasn't broken and contrite before the people. And the people began to question him as a leader. And Absalom would have better judgment, they believed. And Absalom would be a better leader. And he would care more about us. I mean, look at David. We can't trust him. He killed Uriah, a virtuous man, and stole his wife. I mean, what can we trust David to do doing it? And David had lost him. But these were truly David's people. These were, the Israelites were, and Joab did the right thing here. He said, you know, we killed Absalom. The insurrection is done. Okay? This is the rebellious one. Insurrection is done. This is the leader of the rebellion. We've killed him, so it did no difference than if David had been in battle, right? And they'd have killed David, it'd have been done. Right? Absalom would have been reigned and would have been king and they would have figured out a way to get together here. Because this is a civil war. There's no win in a civil war. There's no celebration of victory in a civil war. This is brother against brother, man. This is not enemies. This is brothers against brothers. This is people fighting each other that should not be fighting and doing it. So as soon as the cause for the insurrection was done, as soon as Absalom was killed, he blew the trumpet and said, enough, enough, okay? We're going to have to reconcile with these people. We're going to have to get it together. We live in the same nation. We are the nation Israel. We need to stop. Don't take vengeance out on them. Yes, they were wrong. Yes, they were bad. Yeah, he killed your friend over there behind the oak tree. But do not stop now, he said. And all Israel fled, each one to his tent. So Job blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel for Job. Restrain the people. And he took Absalom and cast him into a deep pit in the forest and erected over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, each to his tent. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to preserve my name. So he named the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's monument to this time. That's a different statement. You know, I think Absalom in a lot of ways, you know, it's just like the enemy. Absalom was suffering from bitterness, from his dad's failure. And the truth is that if we look back in, chapter 12, Absalom actually had three sons earlier. Okay? So it sounds like his sons had died on doing it. Because Absalom had three sons earlier. So the enemy is pretty purposeful when he senses this. You know, we tend to think of bitterness as being a small little part of me. But that doesn't determine me. I'm all determined by this. I've just got this little seed of bitterness here. Be sure the enemy will water and feed and fertilize and cause that to grow so it consumes you. He says, you know, Absalom had said, I don't have any sons to carry my name. His sons had died, I guess, because it says he had three sons and a daughter on doing it. So he was given a disgraceful, in the Mideast, it was still a deal when somebody that was famous, a famous bad guy was put somewhere and buried somewhere. It was tradition when people, every time they go back, people take rocks and throw on there. Okay? Throw rocks on top of this pile that was there. It sounds like they took care of it once. But on the other hand, this was, you know, Joab was following the law and what was done, right? Let me look a minute, because this is rightfully what was happening. God was saying, this is what it looks like. If any man, in chapter 21, verse 18, it says, if any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother, and when they chastise him, he will not even listen to them, then his father and mother shall seize him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gateway of the home of his hometown, and they shall say to the elders of the city, the son of ours is stubborn and rebellious, and he will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear of it and fear. Commandment in Deuteronomy. They were still under the law. Did that fit Absalom? Yeah. Absalom was a rebellious son that had done it. And in a sense, Joab did that. They stoned him. They covered him with stones. Covered him with, you know, that was the end of Absalom. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, please let me run and bring the king the news that the Lord has freed him. That the Lord has freed him from the hand of his enemies. Remember Ahimaaz, he was one of Zadok's sons. He was one that was telling David what was going on with Absalom when he entered Jerusalem. And as the priests were there listening to what was happening. They went and told David, they ran and told David, they were standing outside the city. Remember they hid in the well. And, so these guys were, he was obviously a runner, but he was also the news bearer to David. And I think wanted to take him the news that, you know, it's done, man. I mean, this is done. But Joab said to him, you are not the man to carry the news this day, but you should carry news another day. However, you should carry no news today because the king's son is dead. We can think of two other times when guys brought news to David, thought they were bringing good news, right? Didn't go well. Killed them both, right? Because they came and said, oh, Saul and Jonathan, man, they got killed by the Philistines. Your enemies are dead. And I was even there, man. And I even finally, you know, I'm a hero too. I killed your enemies too. And he goes, yeah, well, you're dead. You know, doing it. Same thing when they killed Ishbosheth. He killed him. Same thing. So the only ones he didn't come at were Joab and his own family. He didn't come at, but he was afraid that this guy was going to get in trouble and get killed on the deal. And Joab said to the Cushite, go tell the king what you have seen. So the Cushite bowed to Joab and ran. Now, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said once more to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me run after the Cushite. And Joab said, Why would you run, my son, since you have no reward for going? But whatever happens, he said, I will run. So he said to him, run, then run. So Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and passed up the Cushite. I don't know quite what's going on here. You know, why he really wanted to, you know. I mean, it's whether he was proud of the fact that he was a fast runner. I'm not sure exactly what, you know. I mean, it was, I don't know what quite was going on. Obviously, he was known for running. He was recognized. People saw him when he ran. They said from a long distance, says, oh, that's Ahimaaz doing it. But I don't know quite what was going on. And David was sitting between the two gates. And the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall and raised his eye and looked, and behold, a man running by himself. And the watchman called and told the king. And the king said, if he is by himself, there is good news in his mouth. And he came nearer and nearer. Then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, behold, another man is running by himself. And the king said, this is also one who's bringing good news. He understood that if, you know, where the Israelites would have fled, they wouldn't have fled this way. They wouldn't have come this way, okay? Because he was at the edge in the northeastern corner. They would have gone to go home. They would have gone back across the Jordan and headed this way, right? So they would have ran. If they had lost, they would have been chasing him. All of David's men would have fled towards the top, right? And they would have all been coming, and the Israelites would have been chasing if the battle had gone bad on doing it. But if the battle had gone well, they would have all gone that way. Maybe they were chasing him, and they would have had to turn and send somebody back towards the other way. So he figured it had to be good news in the deal. And the watchman said, I think the running of the first one is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, this is a good man and comes with good news. And Ahimaaz called and said to the king, all is well. And he prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. He said, blessed is the Lord your God, which is true. I mean, Ahimaaz was the priest's son, man. And he gave credit where credit was due. Blessed is the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord the king. And the king said, it is well with the young man Absalom. He wasn't really, you know, David, I think, it's a little hard to vacillate back and forth because, yes, the love of a father consumed him. On the other hand, he was king and had a responsibility to his country. He had a responsibility to thousands of men who were fighting and risking their lives and giving their lives up for him. He had a tremendous responsibility, and he seemed to be unconcerned about it, I think in his imbalance. And I think his imbalance was motivated by guilt and shame. And the king said, it is well with the young man Absalom. And Ahimaaz said, when Job sent the king's servant and your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was. I assume that was true. He doesn't seem like the liar kind, that he showed up about time they were burying him underneath the rock. I wasn't sure what had happened and what had went on. So then the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still. And behold, the Cushite arrived. And the Cushite said, let my lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. Then the king said to the Cushite, it is well with the young man Absalom. And the Cushite said, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, oh, my son, my son. We'll take that up. Talk about it next week. I don't think that was just the delusionary mourning of it, man. The thing that when it says when David was, he was deeply moved, that's that he had the shakes, the word is, that he was just overwhelmed with the news of Absalom. And I think that it's understandably so. You know, when you look back at, let me read something here quickly and we'll end on this. David understood that he had caused his son's death. And where is it? When Nathan was there, remember when Nathan confronted David and Bathsheba? And I don't know how many people in the nation understood this, But when he did, when he came after him, Nathan pronounces on David. He says in verse of chapter 12, in verse 9, we'll start there. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword, taking his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. And I will take your wives before your eyes, and give them to your companion. And he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. That David knew he had caused his son's death. He knew that he had, that the rebellion of his son, that he had put it in play with his own rebellion, with his own sin. And there's a side of David that is grieving correctly. There's a side of David that is grieving because of his guilt and shame. And I think that there is an important distinction. And I think that it's important for us to look at that. So we'll save that for next week. The encouragement is that we can be set free from guilt and shame. The encouragement is that we do not have to be determined by our sinfulness. We do not have to be determined by our rebellion. We don't have to be determined by the sins of our fathers. We don't have to be determined by our fathers sinning against us and failing us, and our parents failing us, and our world failing us, and our culture failing us. We do not have to be determined by those things. And if we are, if we allow ourselves to continue, if we are not born again, if we are not renewed in our mind, if we do not appropriate the power of Jesus to set us free, we will destroy and continue to destroy our families. And the sins of a father will be visited on your sons for generations. But there is great hope. There is great hope that we do not have to be determined by that. We do not have to parent by guilt and shame. We can parent in the truth and the power of God. We can parent in light, not in darkness. And that's because of what Jesus did. And David looked forward to what Jesus did through the sacrifices, just like we are absolutely dependent and utterly dependent on what Jesus did. So I would, all of us, I think it's an important question. Are we born again? Can we be set free from those things? Because all of us should ask that, be very careful. Look at what does the Bible say being born again looks like? What does the Bible say? Not what your church said, not how you were raised, not what you were conditioned to believe. Because if we are not born again, we will trash not only our own lives, we will not only live in the judgment of our own sins for eternity, but we'll do that to our children. We'll do it to our children and the people around us. Like David did. David's kingdom was trashed. Now, the sweet thing is, God said, I will be your defender, I will be your protector, and he was. It meant his own son getting killed. But God protected him in this resurrection. God restored him to the kingdom. God restored his kingdom, and through Solomon, and through, through the King of Kings, the son of David, Jesus, kept his promise. Let's pray. God, I thank you that you are a holy father, meaning not aloof, not some priest hiding in the back of a church. Doesn't talk much and just says, and acts weird. You're a holy father, meaning that you are completely other than. That's what holy means. Completely other than. Set apart from. You're a perfect father. And I thank you that
that we can look at the failures of fathers and learn what you aren't. And I thank you that we can look at the failures and realize that the desperate need to be like you. I thank you that we can look at you and your character and realize that you're absolutely trustworthy. I thank you that we can look at you and realize that it is good. It is wondrous. It is, you are worthy of us completely regarding you as our master and regarding us as your slaves. I thank you that if we're willing to seek you as we would silver or gold, if we're willing to pursue your character and your nature, we will come to that conclusion. We will know that. But if we take the hardness of our heart and we plow the furrows in it and allow your seed to be planted, that we'll grow up and produce fruit. And that's what being born again is. They weren't saved on the side of the road when they sprung up, any more than the birds snatched them. They didn't produce fruit. And you say that the sign of salvation is producing fruit, good fruit, your fruit, not religious dutiful deeds, but fruit that you call the result of a right relationship with you. So God, I thank you for that. I thank you that we can learn from the story of what not to do and what to do. As David was broken and contrite and left Israel and was obedient to you, was submissive to you and came back under authority, came back, he was an accountable man. He wasn't an accountable man when he killed Uriah and took Bathsheba. He was not accountable to anyone. And the destruction in his life and everyone around him was imminent and obvious as he was accountable and submissive in his life. You blessed him in spite of the pain and the sorrow and the tragedy. You blessed him. You blessed him with the protection from his enemies. You blessed him with restoring the kingdom. You blessed the people. And I thank you that that is the God you are, that you are willing to take us all if we will be broken and contrite before you. And redeem us. Redeem what we have trashed. Redeem what the enemy has stolen. I thank you we can come in the name of Jesus. Amen.